and Kurt for inviting me. So what I want to do today, the fishes will go away. They're not going away. What I want to do today is I actually decided to talk to you today about the part of the work that I do, which really does focus on language and really does kind of flesh out empirically what was said in the paper that I wrote with Noam that appeared a week or so ago. And I want to start out with a comment that my good friend and colleague David Premack made. Premack, in his 1986 book, Gavagai, which is a play on Quine's discussion of word and word meaning, said that, look, even if the lowly chicken had syntax, it would have nothing interesting to say. Now, it's kind of a profound comment because, even though it's very playful, typical Premack style gets right at a key insight, which is that even if you were to give something like a chicken the machinery of syntactic production of grammar, they just don't have the conceptual resources to take that machinery and generate interesting things to say. Well, that's a really an assumption. And I think since Premack's time, actually, quite a lot's been done on actually the lowly chicken to suggest that actually they do have relatively interesting conceptual representations about the world, and that maybe the limiting factor is the machinery underlying syntax. So that's just a hypothesis and a possibility. What I want to do today, and sort of the big question, it's one that I've been interested in for a very long time, and it's a big question that I will never answer by the time I die, but it will hopefully be something that other people will begin to answer, is to really just lay out the ideas in terms of what the faculty of language is, who has it, and how it evolves. Okay? And the reason why I think that's important is because I think the field in general that's been interested in language, language development, and language evolution has not really understood what the problem is, and in particular, just for one version of it, has not really understood what Chomsky's version of the view is. Not like that's the only view, but it's one view, it's been a very dominant, a very powerful view, and therefore it needs to be taken seriously. So, I love this picture. So, let me just tell you, actually, there's a digression, and I make two points. First of all, you should feel free to interrupt me at any point in time for clarification. If it's a really big question, I might want to hold it to the end. But anything about clarification, especially with respect to methods, because most of you are familiar with work on people, and I'll be telling you about work on non-human animals to a large extent. As Howard mentioned, many of the techniques will be familiar to you because they're techniques that have been largely used with human infants, but if you're unclear, just stop me at any point. I'm happy to kind of go through it again. There's a curiosity with this paper that many people, I think, when they saw it, they're kind of jaw-dropped. And it wasn't because I was senior to Noam. I think it was more to do with the fact that typically evolutionary theory and Noam Chomsky have been very unhappy bedfellows. That most people have read him as saying, there's nothing that evolutionary theory can tell us about language. And in fact, many people who have read Steve Pinker's work have seen him as being a Chomskyan with an evolutionary view. Right. So what I want to claim, and I think Howard put it exactly right, is that in some sense people have misunderstood his view, because in the 50s, when Noam really took down Skinner in his really heavily critical review of On Verbal Behavior, one of the things he pointed out in that review was that the Skinnerians were thinking about the problem in the wrong way, about kind of cognition. And the people who were thinking about it the right way were the ethologists, those who were studying animal behavior. And in fact, the fathers of ethology, the grandfathers of ethology, Nico Tinbergen and Conrad Lorenz and Carl von Frisch, because they were thinking about the instincts to learn. In fact, that's a phrase that the ethologist William Thorpe really coined in one sense, that Peter Mahler, my postdoctoral advisor, later took on, and that Pinker captures in the title of his book, The Language Instinct. So Chomsky really saw that deep insight, I think, early on, and it's what really promoted him to kind of push the views he's been pushing over the last many years. I know you've kind of gone through the discussion of some of his views, so I won't spend a lot of time on it, but just to say that the revolution that Noam really began, many people think of that as only being a revolution in language, but it really was a revolution in the cognitive sciences much more generally. And the difficulty for people interested in evolution, and in particular comparative work, is that many have read his views on this, that animals have just nothing to say of interest in terms of linguistics because what they do seems to be relatively trivial in terms of what we are doing with language. Well, here's where I think the problem begins. This is actually a figure from that paper. And what I want to do for you today is just give you a sense of what I think the sort of topography is of the research question. And it really kind of captures some level of the distinction that Noam made over 50 years ago, really. The first thing to keep in mind is that for him, I'm saying this is a universal view, it's by no means a universal view, is an important distinction has to be made between the internal language, what he's often referred to as I language, and the external language. In one sense, the kind of playground empirically for linguists has been the E language, the external language, is what we produce, as a way of revealing what the internal computation is. So in fact, Noam's going on record as saying that, look, the fact that we use this internal communication for language is not really what's of interest. What's of interest is to figure out what the internal computation is. So for him, that machinery of the mind, the internal part, is of what's interest, and language is simply a way of getting at what that is. Okay. Well, here's one way of thinking of the problem of the faculty of language. The first thing to consider is that there's stuff that's internal to the organism, and then there are things that are external to the organism. And what I want to focus in on is two senses of the faculty of language, which I've sort of just given as acronyms, the faculty of language in a broad sense and the faculty of language in a narrow sense. And here's just the kind of cut I want to make. The two key pieces of the faculty of language in the broad sense that I think we've actually got a lot of work on, especially from a comparative perspective, has to do with the sensory motor pieces, and that's if you're speaking, the vocal apparatus, the fact that it can generate sound, and the perceptual side, the fact that it can decode that sound. Or, as you all well know, the fact that if you produce sign language, a fully good natural language, you've got a motor system that is generating signs and a visual system which is decoding it. So that's where the sensory motor bit comes in. This part here, also a part of the faculty of language in the broad sense, consists of the conceptual intentional systems. And that's really the semantic system, what words mean, how we categorize things in the world, how we conceptualize them, and our intent to communicate that information. Okay? So that's what goes into this part. Now, before getting to this middle bit in red, of course, these have different representational structures. The representation of a phoneme is different than the representation of a concept. And yet, those two have to talk to each other. So, even though these have been listed as separate components, this white line is meant to indicate that there's an interface between them. They have to be able to talk to each other. Okay? And that's an important thing to figure out. How do they talk to each other? Okay. And then lastly, this bit in the middle, which I'll refer to as the recursive system, which is the part, the machinery, that takes discrete elements and recombines them to create an infinite variety of meaningful expressions. And critically here, when Noam began to think about this, he was not saying at all that this is unique to language. He appreciated very early on, as did many other people, that the capacity for recursion is something that we use in many domains. Math, possibly social relationships, and maybe others. Now that's important because I take it that when Susan Karen Lispelke came and spoke, they talked about domain-specific kinds of mechanisms. I am not talking about recursion being a domain-specific mechanism. Neither did Noam. It's just a part of the machinery that language uses. And it's an open question, which we'll come back to throughout today, about whether that mechanism evolved for language and then was taken advantage of in things like mathematics, or if it evolved in mathematics and was taken advantage of for language, or if it evolved for some other reason and was simply parasitized by these different domains. Unclear. Yeah.
So is the graphical representation a bit confusing because it represents the structure and not a mechanism?
Yeah, this is purely schematic. It's hard to actually figure out how to represent it. Right. So I'm not saying this is a structure that's located in a particular part of the brain. I mean, it would be able to be distributed a whole set of circuitry. Unclear, right? But this interfaces. This does too.
Okay.
So I was going to answer that, but you kind of jumped the gun. So just like these two pieces have to interface, these two pieces have to interface with recursion as well. Absolutely. Now, just to sort of foreshadow an argument that some of you may have come across, recently in a very, very powerful book that I highly recommend, Ray Jackendoff has published a book called The Foundations of Language, where he tries to argue, and I think very forcefully, that within each of these two bits the faculty of language in terms of sensory motor, and conceptual intentional, there are recursive mechanisms going on. So in terms of word formation, there's a recursive operation. You've got to string together things to create...
You don't want that anymore.
This recursive system is possibly operating in each of these as well. Okay, so maybe operating for syntax, operating for phonology, and operating for semantics. Okay, that's a view that's very interesting and important. I'm not going to talk about that too much. The point is, what is this machinery doing? Okay, and what extent is this information shared with other species? Okay, so the critical thing here is this is simply a framework to think about the problem. Okay, now I want to make three claims, and then I want to try to see if I can defend them empirically. So the first claim is that human language and other generative cognitive abilities, like mathematics, depend upon the use of a finite set of elements to create a potentially infinite array of expressions. That's simply repeating, in one sense, the definition or a definition of recursion. And that leads to what people have often referred to as discrete infinity. Okay, so it's not infinite in terms of it's not possible to kind of test infinity in some sense. It's discrete in terms of it's bounded in some sense. This internal computation, often referred to as recursion, must interface, this goes back to your question, with both the sensory motor and the conceptual intentional systems. Now, this is where evolution and comparative work comes in. Although non-human animals have access to computational mechanisms that operate over abstract variables, I'll give you some examples of those, all these computations can be handled by what's often referred to as finite statistical rules. Specifically, they are local relationships. But what happens when you basically have a recursive system is now you have computations that can operate at a distance, long-range relationships. As a simple example, when you hear me say the word if, you've set up in your head already a dependency somewhere down the line that there'll be something like then coming up. But I can say, if today we went to the market, I can keep embedding things in there, then. But at some point that relationship has to happen, and that's what this open-ended recursive system gives us. Okay? Animals don't seem to have it. That's the claim I'm going to make. They thus lack this kind of open-ended system that recursion provides us, that's characteristic of human language and other generative systems like mathematics. So that's the comparative claim. A third comparative claim is this. Although non-human animals lack that recursive capacity, which is key for the faculty of language, they share with humans most, if not all, of the sensory motor and conceptual intentional pieces. In particular, data from lots of non-human primates, other animals as well, indicate that perceptual mechanisms are entirely homologous. For those of you who don't know about comparative biology, let me just make a distinction right up front about ways in which things can be similar. Homology refers to cases where you compare two different species and you find they both share a trait in common by common descent. They both had an ancestor they shared in common that had that trait. In contrast, you can also have two species sharing a similar trait by what's often referred to as an analogy or a homoplasy. That's where the common ancestor did not share that trait. So an example, which we may come back to, songbirds learn their vocal repertoire in precisely the same way that we learn our language. There seems to be a sensitive period of development where if they don't have exposure to the native song, or in our case, the native language, they will acquire something that's aberrant given the species' typical norm. However, non-human primates do not have that kind of system of vocal acquisition, so songbirds and humans represent a case of homoplasy or analogy, not homology. So here what I'm referring to is homology in the sense that it's a shared ancestor. And that's true for the perceptual mechanisms or all the sensory motor ones and the conceptual intentional ones. Yep?
So do songbirds also use recursive actions as a... I mean, the question I'm trying to ask you is, are we looking at a trait that non-human animals don't have that is unique to human speech, or are there animal forms of communication interspecies that use these same recursive actions? They just don't need the ones that you need to have to create human language.
Okay, my claim is that no animal has recursion, period, that it is uniquely human. Okay, that's the claim I'm going to try to defend today for you, right? So there's the question on the comparative level is, one, does any species have these things, right? Because that rules out the uniqueness claim. The second one is, do non-human primates have these traits? Because then you can argue that we inherited it from them as opposed to independently evolving it. In the case of the songbird human case, we and they independently evolved these. Okay, so those are very different kinds of claims. One, the simple presence of a trait in another animal will rule out the uniqueness claim in humans. The fact that it's in a different species that doesn't have a common ancestor with us just says that it evolved in a different way independently in those two lineages. Everybody clear on that? Yep.
Did you speak up?
What's the difference between recursion and memory?
Oh. A recursive operation will require certain kinds of memory, but memory acts as a constraint on it. So here is an example. For any sentence you give me, I'll give you a longer one. Okay? So you just give me any sentence and I'll say, Mary believes that. Whatever you said. Right? Okay. So we can keep going on forever. Right? But at some point, the number of embedded phrases that I have, you're going to lose track of because of constraints on working memory. Let me just go back here quick. Your question is a very important one for that figure I just showed you. The operations of these things are going to be constrained. This is important because Chomsky's interest is in the kind of the purity of the computation, independently of anything else. But of course, its expressiveness is constrained by all sorts of things. I mean, I can't just speak for an hour without taking a breath, right? So respiration is going to constrain that, right? But that's a constraint on the expressiveness on the computation. It's not a constraint on the actual computation. Right? It's what the computation can do. So working memory is going to constrain how I communicate with you. Okay? And your question is important for what's going to come down the line empirically, because the question becomes, do animals, may they have the computation, but they don't have it in their communication because their memory simply doesn't allow them to store in mind these long strings they could potentially produce, and therefore it's useless. Right? And that's just the possibility, well, what if you give them an artificial system, which people have tried with apes, maybe they could do it there. Right? So those are just, again, open empirical questions which we'll be coming to. Okay? But all these things are constraints at the internal level. When we come over here, here are constraints in the external environment. If I have recursion, I have language, but you're sitting on the other side of a wall, I mean, that environment's a physical barrier to me communicating with you. That's a physical constraint of the environment on the recursive system. It's not a constraint of the computation. Okay? So all these are constraints too. If I'm speaking English and you don't have a clue about what English is, that's a cultural phenomenon, right? You can't understand what I say. We're done. Right? Recursion or not. Yeah.
I have a question about the model of the recursion mechanism. It would say that mathematical model of that would be similar to a fractal model of just endless kind of self-replication of particular grammatical structures.
There are lots of ways in which you can get open-endedness. Okay, so openly expressive systems, right? I mean, genetics is like that.
That's a specific genetic structure rather than just endlessly replicating that would create infinite.
Right, but it's not endless. It's the point about recursion, at least with respect to language, is that it's not as endlessly replicating, right? It's not you're just like doing duplicates of things, right? There are particular operations, and there are particular abstract variables over which it operates, right? So nouns and subjects and adjectives and so forth, right? So it's not that it just says replication, right? That's not what recursion is. It's not replication, right? So there are things that are open-ended, but they're not open-ended in terms of their expressive power, right? If I just say cat, 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 it's open-ended. I can keep doing that forever, right? But it's not open-ended as an expressive power.
But there's a whole class of Asian-based models.
Whole class.
Which do seem to be creative using recursion.
Sure. Oh, there's lots of ways of recursion which we can tap. So I said, this is not domain specific, right? This is very important, right? Noam never argued, right? In fact, if you push him, he says, well, what's recursion for? He says it's for talking to yourself. Like he thinks the fact that we talk to each other is kind of irrelevant, you know? What you do most of the time is you talk to yourself, right? I mean, he's probably right at some level. It's not clear how testable it is, but the point, I mean, his point is that, look, what we're doing most time is we're sitting having arguments with ourselves, right? But recursion, yeah, it's kind of, I mean, you know, the absent mind professor talking to himself is probably a truism, right? So yes, recursion can be seen in lots of places, but it's not just open-endedness is not it. It's open-endedness in terms of expressive power. So mathematics is like that, genetics is like that. But just to make a concrete example, you have to have discrete, unblendable entities, right? Paint is not like that, right? Red and white creates pink. I can keep creating new colors, right? It's open-ended, but you lose the elements. That's not true in genetics, it's not true in mathematics, it's not true in language. So that's an important difference, okay? Okay. So, let me just now tell you about how I've been trying to go at this problem for 20 or so years now, at least a little bit of success. This is what, for those of you unfamiliar with it, is what's typically called a phylogenetic tree. It's a diagram of history, evolutionary history in this case. People have actually used this in linguistics for human history, so you can use it for lots of reasons. But basically what it tells you are branching relationships between species for whatever you want to look at. In this case, this is a part of the primate phylogeny, and here we have the newer monkeys, which branched off from this line, which ultimately became humans, at around 30 to 40 million years ago. So this is to give you a sense of the time depth in which I'm comparing. And this is a species you'll actually hear a lot about today, which is a small species of New World monkey that I work on here in William James Hall, called cotton-top tamarins. They are a small monogamous species that lives in the rainforest of Colombia. We've also been studying a large population of rhesus monkeys that lives on an island off the coast of Puerto Rico called Cayo Santiago. It's a fantastic field site because these animals were put in this island almost 70 years ago, and they've been under intensive observation ever since. So it's a great place to do experiments because the animals kind of treat you like moving trees. So they're very habituated. The sample size is huge. And then we've been studying a population of chimpanzees in Uganda. So this is a completely natural population, doing a bunch of experiments and observations with them. And then comparing them with humans. As Kurt said, for me the target has been always human infants. And this is not baby George. I don't think he was that cute. Human infants, and here's the reason why they're the target. There's both a theoretical reason and an empirical reason. The theoretical reason is that if you want to understand things like to what extent does language play a role in conceptual development, the kinds of things that Liz and Susan spoke to you about a few weeks ago, the argument I've always made is that humans are the wrong species. Right? And here's the reason why. Humans evolved the brain to do language, right? So even though an infant doesn't have the expressive capacity for language, right, and maybe not even the comprehension capacity for language, they have a brain that was designed to do language. So the critical test is with species like this that don't have, at least most people don't want to give them, anything like our language, okay? So that's one reason, theoretically, is that you can test the very strong hypotheses. I don't know what Susan spoke to you about, but she has written on certain kinds of empirical cases where she's made the claim that the child does not acquire the conceptual capacity X until they have language. In other words, language is necessary to acquire the conceptual ability. If you now show that non-human animals have that conceptual ability without language, you can rule out at least a strong version of the hypothesis, right? Language may play a role in conceptual development, but it's certainly not necessary, okay? So that's why, theoretically, the comparative method is important. Now, the other reason is because it turns out that human infants are in exactly the same methodological boat, researchers are, that we are. We can't ask them about what they think or know with language. So the methods used to test infants' conceptual abilities, perceptual abilities, have to be at some level the same that we use for animals. But one of the things that Howard mentioned at the beginning was that what we've been trying to do is take a different approach from what the traditional animal learning crowd has done. Typically what they've done is to train animals to do things and see how they generalize. What we have been interested in is what animals do spontaneously. Because after all, much of what's interesting about human cognition is what we do spontaneously. Right? So we've been using some of the exact same methods that have been employed with infants, developing some of our own, and going back and forth with Susan and Liz, really sharing our methods to get really elegant, what we think of elegant comparative data. Okay, so here's what I'll do today. The first thing I want to talk about is the possibility that there are homologous mechanisms for production. Most of what I'll be talking about today has to do with the spoken part of language rather than sign language. So this has to do with the vocal production system. Then I'll talk about homologous perceptual mechanisms. And then I will end with homologous computational mechanisms. Okay. So what I will not talk about today, but maybe in the question period we can talk about it if you have questions, is the conceptual intentional part. So I'll be focusing mostly on FLB sensory motor and the recursive system, and some issues having to do with their interfaces. Okay, so first, homologous production. So just to get you anchored, for those of you who don't know about speech production, there are two critical facts. These were facts that were beautifully articulated by Gunnar Font, one of the grandfathers of speech production and perception in the 60s. And the basic idea in speech production is that you have a source called the larynx, which generates sound. So as air travels through, the vocal folds vibrate. That generates the source, which is what we hear perceptually as the pitch of our voice. That information then travels up above the larynx, through the pharynx, comes out at a 90-degree angle through our mouth, and some of it through our nose. That supralaryngeal vocal tract acts as a filter on the sound, but the source and the filter are independent. Here's the way to think about it. When speech comes out of our mouth, the vocal tract filters it, and what it creates are what speech scientists refer to as formants. What formants are, metaphorically, are kind of windows that allow certain frequencies to come through and suppress others. So thinking about kind of a light source, where metaphorically this is the larynx producing sound, in this case it's light, the light travels through a room. If there are windows, that light will get through those windows, and when it hits the wall, which is opaque, it will not. That will therefore create certain bits of light coming through, other ones not. That's what the vocal tract does. It will emphasize certain frequencies and it will de-emphasize others. When I speak, or when an adult woman speaks, or when a young child speaks, what makes the sentence mean the same thing are the formant frequencies. What makes us sound a little bit different is the pitch of our voice, which is due to both the length of the vocal tract and the weight of the vocal folds. Okay? But if a child says, "This is a cat," I can say the same sentence because I'm putting my vocal tract into exactly the same position. To make that clear, let me just give you a little demo to show you that there is that source filter independence. Here is a sentence of human speech.
Where in the hell are you?
Okay. Now what I'm going to do is the following. I'm going to take two different vocalizations, one from a bison, which sounds like this, and one from a narwhal. And I'm going to take the source, the what comes out of the larynx, and I'm going to pass it through the vocal tract of that male who just said that sentence. Okay? With the same sentence. All right? So here is the bison version. Perfectly comprehensible, right? Nobody any problem with that means? Okay, and here's the narwhal version. Okay. So you got it, right? And the reason why you got it is because the filter is what's giving you the meaning, giving you the words, right? The source is independent of the filter. Okay. Well, a question which has been of great interest to anthropologists, archaeologists, biologists, psychologists, is the phenomenon which has been long described since the 40s, which is that our vocal tract seems to be quite different from that of all other species. And in particular, what happened apparently in evolution at some point, and it's debatable exactly when, is that the larynx dropped into our chest further down than in other primates, and that created a very different vocal tract shape. And Phil Lieberman has argued that it was the descent of the larynx that was in a unique adaptation for speech. It's at that point that we have language. And he anchors that somewhere around the Neanderthals. Okay. Well, here is what he was referring to. These are MRs of human, chimpanzee, and a rhesus macaque. What you see here in red is the vocal tract. And for humans, it really is a two-tube system. It goes sort of straight here and then drops down an angle. Whereas for all other animals, it's basically a single tube. The larynx has not dropped into the chest, creating that two-tube system. And for Lieberman, it's that shape which has really given us a unique vocal apparatus and allowed us to explore a sound space that other animals just don't explore. Okay. So for Lieberman, the hypothesis, a very dominant one, has been around for about 20 years now, is that the descent of the larynx was a unique adaptation for speech. Now, this came as a cost. Gary Larson kind of captures it. Fortunately for Sparky, Zeke knew the famous Rex maneuver. When our larynx descended, we went from a species that could now choke on our food when we talked. It decoupled in other animals. So that's why the Heimlich maneuver is so important, because we can kill ourselves. So here's the interesting developmental phenomenon. is that we are born with a vocal tract that's like all other animals. And at the age of about 3 to 4 months, the larynx descends, which coincides, interestingly, with the beginning of babbling-like sounds. And here's just a little animation to show you how that happens. So this is a baby, larynx is high, and here's what happens over development. Okay, so that's what happened, that's where it started, and that's where it ends up. Okay? So that descent of the larynx is crucial. It's now allowing the baby to create sounds. There's a cost to that because now you have a trade-off between digestive efficiency and speaking efficiency. Okay? So that's nice because in evolution, you have compromises. So at some point, there was strong selection that made that thing happen, right? But at a cost, because now you can choke. Animals can't choke like we can. All right. Well, the question is, evolutionarily, did the descent of the larynx, was that an adaptation for speech? Okay. Well, here is something that a postdoc of mine, Tecumseh Fitch, who is a co-author on the paper with Noam, has been working on now for about 5 years, which is an alternative hypothesis for thinking about the descent of the larynx. And here's how the argument goes. We know that in many animal species, body size correlates with reproductive success, the number of babies you produce. Big animals tend to be dominant, tend to have more mates, tend to have more babies. In the logic of evolution, more babies is good, right? More genes you pass on, the better you are. Okay, so it pays to be big. We also know that the length of the vocal tract correlates with body size. Bigger animals have longer vocal tracts. And we also know, let's see, this is... We also know, let me go back here, that the length of the vocal tract is correlated with formant frequencies. The longer the longer the vocal tract, the lower the formant frequencies, and therefore, formant frequencies are cues to body size. So if you're a female moving around the world and you hear an animal's got low formants, that's a big male, you can now go to that animal, and that will be a good animal to mate with. So, lower formant frequencies are a cue to body size. Okay, and they're an honest indicator of body size. You can't fake that because it's a constraint of the vocal tract length. So the question is, can animals do anything with their vocal tract to exaggerate body size? Well, one way to do it is to lower your larynx. Right? If you lower the larynx, your vocal tract is longer. Can animals do that? Well, here's an example from deer. What I want you to look at is this little area right here. This is the equivalent of the Adam's apple. This is exactly where their larynx is. This is a male producing his territorial call. Just put a fine point on it, right? So there's evidence, which there now is in many species, that animals can lower their larynx. And by lowering the larynx, they're changing vocal tract length, changing body size. We also have these very odd and unique adaptations in other species, like these birds, where they have what's called tracheal elongation, these extraordinary kind of French horn-like structures that makes their vocal tract longer. Okay? And therefore, will therefore change the formant frequencies. These tend to be seen in a more exaggerated form in males as opposed to females, the sex that's giving these territorial calls. So again, giving evidence that the vocal tract length seems to be an adaptation as a cue for body size. So the hypothesis that this leads to, which is Tecumseh Fitch's hypothesis, is the following. The descent of the larynx originally evolved to convey information about body size, but then was co-opted, or in the words of Stephen Jay Gould, exapted, not an adaptation for, but a co-opted trait, for speech production. In other words, the descent of larynx didn't evolve for speech, but it's used in speech. So, said here, the descent of larynx does not represent an adaptation for speech, although it currently plays a significant role in speech production. What is unique is a fixed larynx in that position. We are the only species that has the larynx locked into that lower position. But the descent of it and the relationship between that position and formant frequencies is not an adaptation for speech. Yeah?
So do we see
Why the lowering of the larynx is unique to humans? Why other species analogously evolved the same adaptation to take humans as females?
So we can do moves like that too. So the question of why ours got fixed and other species don't, totally open question. Unclear, and unclear when exactly it happened.
It did happen that other species would have speech.
Well, okay. So let's very good question. So two things. The first question is what is speech, right? So what counts as speech, right? So the question is, how can you define the operation without being tautological? What's what we produce, right? The Fitch hypothesis, somebody saying the following thing. Since other animals can drop the larynx, right, and that correlates with a body size cue, the descent of the larynx, an alternative hypothesis for it, is that it evolved as a cue for body size. Okay, once that evolved, now we can now use the fact that we have the descent of the larynx to create sounds that other animals can't. Now, why it got fixed is unclear, right? So that's a completely ambiguous phenomenon, and unfortunately, the comparative work will not help us because there's no other comparative data point, right? So now you're left with a fossil record, okay? So the question is, can the fossil record ever tell us what the selection pressure was that created that fixed vocal tract?
Right,
don't know.
Right?
Well, what it is well, see, that's an open question because the thing is that, see, lots of animals have a variety of sounds they can produce. Some of them overlap with ours, some of them don't overlap at all, right? The question is, and this will come back again, is what's unique? Let me just bring up to here. So to summarize, and this is going to answer your question, I think, in part. Given the fact that humans can produce a fully comprehensible language in the sign domain, in the visual domain, right, we don't need sound to have that part of language. Right. In fact, what makes human language so interesting in terms of any other form of communication is the fact that it's unconnected with modality. Right. We can do it visually and we can do it auditorily. And this is where animals are wildly different. If I go to any species and take their dominant modality of communication, let's say the monkeys I work with, and I mute them, which I wouldn't do, but let's say I just did. Right. So I denervate the larynx. So they can't produce sound anymore. They cannot now go into the visual modality and have the same expressive power the way we can if we're born deaf. That means our brain is very, very different, right? We evolved a system. This goes right back to Noam's original argument. The internal computation was independent of modality. It can be taken on by whatever you want. Okay. So in terms of the speech production issue, it's not the case that just because we have a vocal tract like this, that if animals had that, they'd have speech. They'd have the sounds we can produce. Right, but that doesn't seem to be where the interesting game is in terms of thinking about the evolution of the faculty of language.
So if I understand correctly, we can't talk of the language module. We can just talk about several speech-related or language-related adaptations or mechanisms that evolve analogously even in humans.
That's right. Exactly right. So within
the human.
So the whole point of this kind of research enterprise is to figure out what pieces of the faculty language are shared with other animals and what pieces evolved uniquely, right? And what I'm saying right now is that on the production side, most of it is shared, right? They don't produce the same sounds, but in terms of the articulatory gestures, source, filter, independence, those are all shared mechanisms, okay? What's different is the locking of the larynx, okay? But that's just the kinds of sounds we make, right?
But
I haven't gotten there yet, right? I haven't gotten anything else but production so far. So empirically, all I've said is that so far, there's a unique anatomical adaptation, which is the locking of the larynx. But there are lots of unique anatomical adaptations in other species. I mean, the sounds that a bat can produce is a unique anatomical adaptation for bats, right? So we can't do that. So the fact that you've got a unique anatomical adaptation isn't what's giving us the story.
I guess I'm more a little bit
oh, sorry, I probably misspoke then. This has nothing to do with any kind of sex biases. Okay, so in deer, okay, they too can drop their larynx. Okay, so this is not a sex specific thing. What I was saying is that in cases where we've actually got both behavioral and anatomical or physiological data, what the data are showing is that females prefer to mate with males who have lower pitch, lower formant frequencies than higher formant frequencies. It's simply a correlate, right? It's that why would it pay to do this evolutionarily, right? It's not saying that this is what happens in humans. Although it turns out, okay, that studies that an undergraduate in our department did is that if you actually control for things, females and males both show perceptual abilities to match body size correlates to formant frequency. So that perceptual ability is in both sexes.
But the male don't make the call.
Oh, in those species, that's absolutely right. But clearly not us. Okay. But let me tell you that this is not so far from what humans do. There are data now, a couple of things that are very interesting. There's a lot of things I could show you more, but I just didn't bring everything. Two things. Before puberty, if you look at the degree to which little boys and little girls protrude their lips when they're speaking, little boys protrude their lips more than little girls do. What is that doing? It's lowering their it's making the vocal tract longer. Okay? Given the same kind of utterances, they're protruding more. Now, what you also find is that in development, pre-puberty, vocal tract lengths in boys and girls are indistinguishable. At puberty, boys now, vocal tracts become longer, and post-puberty, a highly significant difference. So our vocal tracts are just longer than yours. Okay? So those sex differences exist in our species too.
Yeah, I guess it seems like you said that's kind of the assumption is that because the way it works now, it's very easy for people to adapt and say that, you know, to a certain perspective, the only reason why you can help me is to prevent you speaking.
It's not so that men can speak. That's not the argument that I made or that Fitch made. So maybe this is a good time to actually take just a slight tangent to make sure we're on the same page. A lot of people have this kind of aversive response to evolutionary arguments, and there's good reason to be aversive for some of the arguments because some of them are kind of pathetic. But here's the reason why you shouldn't be just generally skeptical. Okay, why is this keep going on? Let me give you one case, okay, which is completely different than what I'm talking about, but it'll make the argument. There was interest by biologists in the following phenomenon. In many, many species, the genetic system is going to build traits, anatomical traits, that will be bilaterally symmetrical, like two arms, eyes, and so forth. And if the genetic system is working well, it should build them symmetrically. Because, of course, if you're building legs that are asymmetric, not going to work well, right? Okay. So the extent to which you have symmetry should be an indicator of the genes working well, the developmental program working well, okay? Both their interaction with the environment and so forth. Okay. If that's true, then when females are choosing mates, which is the common mechanism for mate choice, is females typically choosing males, although in some species it's the reverse, they should pick males who are more symmetrical than males who are asymmetrical. Okay, if that logic works. And there are now hundreds of species from insects and fish and birds where this has been true. Now, you do the similar kinds of studies with humans and you find the same result. It would be really weird to argue that we're just different. Right? If hundreds of species do it that way, we do it that way, to argue now for some kind of weird cultural invention in humans does not make sense. So the logic of most good, and I'm just subjective, good evolutionary arguments followed by empirical tests are cases like that, where you've got strong empirical evidence of a given phenomenon in a suite of non-human animals. You show very similar kinds of effects in humans, and now you make the argument for an adaptation, right? Because to argue for something different and weird of culture is the least parsimonious explanation at that point. Right? So what I'm saying with respect to the... this is really annoying. I should have turned this off before. Hold on a second. To language, and with respect to specifically speech production, is that the argument that Lieberman made was that the lowering of the larynx was an adaptation for speech. So there's only one way to test that. That's with the comparative data. If you can show the lowering of larynx is happening for something else, then that's a test of the hypothesis. Okay? It makes no claims about why our larynx is doing what it's doing and what happened in the 6 million years of evolution since we diverged from chimps. Okay? It does nothing at all about that. It simply tests the hypothesis that the claim that the lowering of larynx was an adaptation for speech is an alternative. Okay? Yeah.
It seems that you're suggesting that the ability to produce speech even along the line is neither necessary nor sufficient to explain language production better in a Chomsky way. We don't really need the modality of speech. That's not what defines what's unique to language, and yet people that have that ability, or animals that have that ability, don't have the language that we have. So is that accurate to say it's neither necessary nor sufficient?
That's right. I mean, you know, yeah. So going back again to Chomsky's position is that, you know, the question is this. When people say, you know, we have language, the question really is, what do we mean by that? Okay? And so this is an attempt to flesh out what we mean by the faculty of language. Now, for Noam, the two key pieces, which we're kind of building towards, is this internal recursive system and what he referred to as a language acquisition device, right? So what gets you there? For him, right from the start. Now, remember, historically, that when he started in the 50s, very little was known about sign language. In fact, people said sign language isn't a language. Right? That was the claim in those days. But now, through the efforts of lots of people, Ursula Belugi, Laura Batito, we now know that that's not true, that sign language has all the properties of spoken language. Okay, activation of the brain. Right? I mean, all those things follow in parallel. So, but he predicted, in one sense, that it would be amodal. Right? So, in some sense, Lieberman's claim was never really interesting to know, because who cares about speech production? Right? I mean, the fact that we use that is the it's a constraint, right? It's a constraint on the recursive system. Okay, fine, so that's a constraint. Yeah, so that's what he would say. Now, of course, the whole group at the Haskins lab, which I'm going to come to next in perceptual things, critically thought about production perception, because they thought that what's unique to language is what they refer to as the motor theory of speech production. That when we hear speech, we're hearing gestures. Okay, and therefore the production apparatus, which I'm going to come to right now, was critical to thinking about the whole apparatus that the recursive system interfaces with. Right? So Noam's not going to deny that there are interesting interface questions. Right? But for him, that's not where the interesting action is. Right? I mean, again, I think there's been a lot of misinterpretation. Is that, you know, look, we all have a choice in life to make about what we think is going to be interesting, what we're going to work on. Right? People have interpreted him as saying all the rest is bullshit. You know, that's not what he really said. It's just that I'm going to work on this piece. Right? Everybody else can work on those other pieces. Right?
Well, Mark, this is a really big, confusing issue.
It is.
You probably should come back here maybe later. But, you know, like modularity is generally attributed to Chomsky.
Yeah.
This doesn't seem like much of a modularity argument to most of us.
Well, it will when we get to recursion, because, I mean, I think, you know, he thinks, I mean, there are parts of language which really are, in a you know, Fodorian kind of sense, clustered off from the rest of all the systems. I mean, he does still hold to that. But he's willing to, in the paper, he's willing to say that the recursive thing may, in fact, be very, very simple. And maybe domain general. That part may have nothing to do with it. What he thinks is the modular part, all the surface properties of language, all the quirks of WH movement, all that stuff, he thinks that's completely off on its own. Right? So that's the part which is on its own. But yes, we can engage that.
Modularity seems to be much less general in that analysis than in the way many people have interpreted.
That's right.
Including his own students.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I mean, you know, so here's my one of my favorite comments from Steve Pinker when I was writing this. He says, "This is great, Mark, but you realize that probably 1 month after you read this, he's going to say, oh, I deny all the stuff in that paper." Okay, so there was somebody had a question over here. Did I miss somebody? Okay, so let's now talk about perception. Again, for a lot of things I'm going to tell you, there's much more data, right, than I possibly can give you today. So I'm trying to give you just pieces to show you at least the approach. Right, and then how it can go forward. Okay, so now let's go back to another historical claim. This comes from the Haskins lab, and it comes from, in particular, Al Lieberman, not Phil Lieberman, Al Lieberman. And Al claimed in the 60s, actually late 50s, that when speech is produced, it's produced as a physical continuum. So we can create physically, acoustically, a continuum from a ba sound to a pa sound. But when we hear that, that's not how we hear it. We hear it as categories. That there's a certain range of acoustic parameters that indicates that it's a ba, and then with a very sharp discontinuity, everything else is a pa. And when Lieberman made that claim, Lieberman and his colleagues, Michael Stuart Kennedy and others, they claimed that this was unique to speech, and since we're the only species that produces speech, it's unique to humans. So two claims, unique to speech, and unique to humans. Well, that kind of issue got hit from three different directions. The first were a series of studies showing that categorical perception is not unique to speech, that it happens in other kinds of perceptual phenomena, like color perception. You can also create a physical continuum of color, but we perceive things categorically. Secondly, more devastatingly in some ways, was Peter Imus's work in the 70s, showing that even though young infants don't yet produce these sounds, they nonetheless perceive these perceptual boundaries in exactly the same position as do human adults. And most problematic for the theory were studies of non-human animals in the 70s by Patricia Kuhl, who found that in both chinchillas and macaques, when given these exact same speech contrasts, they too place the boundary in exactly the same position. Okay, what's the claim? The claim is not that categorical perception plays no role in speech perception. On the contrary, it clearly does. The claim is that the capacity for categorical perception did not evolve for speech categorical perception.
Mark, you should explain how this is done in chinchillas.
Okay. Well, yeah. So this was done with the classic operant kind of techniques. So you train a chinchilla to press one lever when they hear a ba, and another lever when they hear a pa, and you give them a certain set of those exemplars, and now you give them new ones that fill in the range of variation. And what you find is they place the boundary. Notice they categorize all these here and all the pas there through training studies. So these are classic training studies. And the point here in part was, this, I'm glad actually Howard raised this question, is many people said, well, okay, so you can train the animals to do categorical perception, but they don't sort of spontaneously do it, right? We need spontaneous to infants don't need to be trained. In the infant case, the way you show this in infants is you use a habituation-dishabituation procedure. You habituate them to exemplars of ba until they, in case of a very young baby, you suck on a nipple until they slow down the sucking rates, and then you play them either novel exemplars of ba or pas, and you see whether they dishabituate. Okay, and in the case of babies, you get examine the boundaries in the same positions. So some people just dismissed some of that literature. Other people said, okay, so what? Categorical perception is not unique to humans. Big deal. You know, that was not really interesting anyways. So that was when they dismissed that. And for almost 20 years, all the action in the comparative literature on speech and language had almost all to do with categorical perception. And most people said, look, we're bored with that. It's not interesting anymore, right? Okay. Well, this is interesting because it seems to be an interesting phenomenon about what people do when their work's kind of been dismissed. They change gears and do something completely different. So Pat Kuhl was attributed with the person being who really knocked down the speech is special argument. Now fast forward about 15 years, and here's Pat Kuhl doing something completely different, arguing for what's special to humans. Okay, here's what she did. She wanted to make an analogy with categorization in the visual domain. And what she said was, look, when we categorize things, just the way Eleanor Rocha described in the 70s, we tend to think of certain exemplars as being prototypical of the category and other ones as being non-prototypical. So when we think of birds, we tend to think that are kind of robin-like but not penguin-like. Right? So penguins are not prototypical. Robins kind of capture the feature set that's more prototypical. What Pat said was that you can imagine the same kind of thing happening in the auditory domain where there are certain speech sounds which are kind of really good exemplars, a prototype like this little black thing in the middle, and then things are kind of on the periphery. And that what the prototype does is it acts kind of like a magnet. It kind of draws in exemplars that are like it, that share features in common. So what she decided to do was to test that hypothesis with humans and with non-human primates, in particular, rhesus monkeys. Not Bill Gates. And what she found was that humans have a very clear idea of what counts as kind of a good A sound or an E sound, right? And then reject things that are outside that range. And, again, using kind of habituation, dishabituation, so do babies. So babies, too, even though they're not yet producing those kinds of sounds, have a sense of what counts as a good exemplar and a bad exemplar. But when you test rhesus monkeys, again, with these kind of operant techniques, they fail to show that distinction. So what Kuhl's claim was is that, yes, animals have categorical perception. What they don't have is within-category perception. They don't understand there are prototypical exemplars, and that comes from particular experience with the linguistic environment. So by the age of 6 months, an English-born baby will have a sense of a prototypical A and E sound that is different than a Swedish-born baby. that the linguistic experience is tuning the brain to give you within category meaningful variation that the monkeys just never get.
But it's not relevant to the monkeys. I mean, if the monkeys are doing the test on us, they could say the same thing to us, and we don't display an awareness of the difference in monkey calls.
True. But remember, they have no problem with category perception, and bond power equally irrelevant to them. So on an irrelevancy argument, right, they have as much exposure with BAPA as AE. Right? And where that experience is, they can do categorical perception, they can't do within. Right? So it always is a question. Right? I mean, this your kind of questions are going to probably come up 100 times today as I go through my experiments. It's always a question, well, look, it's maybe just completely irrelevant to them. Right? Right? They don't care, they don't hear it, they're not motivated. Right? The thing is that in training, they are motivated because they're responding to things, they're being reinforced for responses, right? So they're motivated to work, they're often food deprived a little bit, so they're motivated to work and motivated to respond. And the key thing here is that same method, speech sounds, ba-pa, fine, A-E, no. Okay? Yep.
Can we say that, I'll try to formulate it, that animals, as far as categorical perception of animals goes, they can do discrete, they can distinguish discrete categories of non-animal.
Well, I mean, the prototype stuff is not really analog. It's not really analog. I mean, maybe that's not the analogy. There's
blending in of prototype-like auditory experience.
But there's problems. Yeah, but I mean, don't forget the BAPA is a continuum, too. So AIE is a continuum also, right? These are all physical continuum. So it just depends on how you're bounding them, right? So in the sense that you can go from ba to pa physically and then put a break there. You can go from a to e continuously and put a break there. So in both cases, that's true. Well, let me give you some more data. So the first thing is that, well, just the fact that rhesus monkeys can't do it doesn't mean that any species can't do it, right? So compare data hinges, going back to a question earlier, on a wide range of species tested. Right? So the fact that macaques can't do it, I mean, that's one species, right? Well, it turns out the starlings can do it. Okay, so the uniqueness claims goes down in flames, right? But now we have this issue of analogy versus homology, right? Okay, so now we clearly have an analogy, right? Because we do not share an ancestor with starlings that had that capacity. Okay, now that's kind of the state of affairs up until about 1990 or so. Okay, and the field's been kind of quiet, like not many people were doing anything, and I was at a conference with Susan Carey and Liz Belke and Jacques Mailer, where it was really the kind of conference that set me going on, I need to start collaborating with developmentalists and linguists to get this thing off the ground. And Jacques Mailer approached me, and for those of you who don't know him, he's a very distinguished psycholinguist trained in the Chomskyan tradition. And Jacques was talking about a result in his talk that French-born babies who are about 4 to 5 months of age, when run on a habituation-dishabituation procedure using sentences of Dutch, a different language, so they habituate the sentences of Dutch, and then once habituated, you play them sentences of Japanese, will discriminate those two languages. Okay? But take those same babies and now habituate them to sentences of Dutch played backwards, and now test them with sentences of Japanese played backwards, and they do not discriminate those. Jacques' interpretation was the following. You can create clusters of languages by their rhythmic properties, which has to do with the frequency parameters and also the relationship between the duration of vowel sounds and consonants. And you can create clusters of languages that belong to the same rhythmic class and different rhythmic class. Dutch and Japanese come from different rhythmic classes. Now, when you turn languages around, speech around, that is, specifically, what you're doing is you're creating sounds that no human vocal tract can produce. Okay, and that's true of every language. So when I reverse the speech stream, I'm making sound structures that I can't possibly produce. I mean, not just me alone, but anybody in this room can't produce. And the baby may just be going, well, there's some things I can't produce, and there's some more things I can't produce, so it's kind of all the same, right? So they don't discriminate them. They don't show a meaningful distinction. Okay, so that's an interesting question, because if it's true, you predict different patterns for monkeys or other animals tested with the same methods because they can't know what a vocal tract can produce, right? They can't know what a human vocal tract can produce. In fact, it's a different vocal tract. So on that level, animals should be different. So we were motivated to test that hypothesis because it was a very interesting hypothesis and it made a very clear prediction for animal studies, but also because up until this point, everything tested on animals with respect to speech were phonemes. Ah, e, ba, pa. Nothing bigger. No big units. No sentences, nothing like that. So the question is, could they discriminate sentences of different languages based on their rhythmic properties? And could we use the same methods?
Right.
Okay. So Jacques and I, together with some students, Frank Ramus in particular, a grad student, Corey Miller, and an undergraduate, Dylan Morris, ran a study using neonates, because the fact that a four-month-old can do this, the question was, could a human neonate do this? Right, so a couple days old, and cotton-top tamarins. So for the babies, it was a non-nutritive sucking technique, and for the tamarins, and I'll show you this in a moment, it was a head-orienting technique. So briefly, here's the method. We divided the colony, which had about 20 different animals, into two groups. Each group got each of these four conditions: a language change condition, Dutch to Japanese or Japanese to Dutch, and a speaker change, just to check on whether any acoustic differences at all might elicit dishabituation. And they got sentences played backwards, and they got sentences played forward. Okay, so the method was, the animal was placed in an acoustic chamber, a speaker was placed out of sight and behind them, and we watched everything from a computer monitor where we could present the stimuli. So here's what it looks like. The animal would be standing, sitting and holding on to this grill pattern, looking down, away from the speaker, which was behind and up here. That's the position before the playback. We play the playback sound, and now the response is to look back and toward the speaker. Non-reinforced, we give them nothing for doing this. So we're not training them. We're not rewarding them for responding or not responding. Now you may ask, why do they care about speech? We have no idea. But the point is they do. They respond to these sounds. Okay? So that's how it goes. We digitally acquire the video. We then mark the onset of the playback, the offset, and 2 seconds post that. We save this all to a master list so we can then code the information blind to conditions. So we now look at a digital clip. We step through frame by frame. We have no idea what was played back, and we simply score whether they respond or not. We then have multiple coders coding it for reliability, often in the range of 0.9, so very high, and then we refer to the master list to figure out what the conditions were. Okay, so we're completely blind to what's going on, so we can't at all bias how we interpret the responses. And when we do this, what we find in this experiment is the only significant discrimination is the forward language change. They do not discriminate backwards, and they do not discriminate different speakers changing within the language groups. So that suggested to us at the time that the way the tamarins are doing this, which is the way that babies seem to be doing it, is to pick up on rhythmic cues that are available between different languages. Now, if that is true, then we need to do much stronger tests of rhythmic properties. And that's where we are now, which is together with a postdoc of mine, Ruth Tinkoff, we have now gone after this hypothesis. If discrimination between languages, such as Dutch and Japanese, which is what they were given, depends upon rhythmic cues, then tamarins should be able to discriminate languages, any language, from any different rhythmic class. Two different rhythmic classes. But they should also fail to discriminate languages from the same rhythmic class. Okay, because that's true of human babies. They can't discriminate, for example, a French baby can't discriminate Spanish from Catalan. Okay, but they can discriminate Spanish from Japanese. Okay, so what we now need to do is test different rhythmic classes. So we tested them with Japanese, which they got before, versus Polish, a novel language, which comes from a different rhythmic class. And then from the same rhythmic class, English versus Dutch, and we tested it both forward and backward. Now, we had this little insight, which we thought might be cute if it came out, which is the following. In some sense, for tamarins in my colony, which has been around for 11 years, English is their kind of their native language, because they've heard us speak a lot, because we call them out by name. Like, we name our animals after famous psychologists like Pinker and Markman and Bayerjon and Spelke. We call them out. So maybe English is a native language, and that's the case. What we also know is that once you've had enough experience with your native language, then you can discriminate your native language from another language in the same rhythmic class. So maybe they would. So what happened? The only thing they discriminated were the different rhythmic class languages, Polish and Japanese, only in the forward direction, not the within rhythmic class distinction, and for neither when they were played backwards. Okay, so what's the conclusion? Tamarins can discriminate two different languages using rhythmic cues if the sentences are played in a normal forward direction and if the languages come from different rhythmic classes. This is the refrain that you're going to be going home and saying to yourself in your sleep. This perceptual ability did not evolve for language discrimination, even though humans clearly use it for language discrimination, and in fact it may play a key role in the language acquisition device, as many people would have it. A lot of people who look at language acquisition and some of the bootstrapping mechanisms that the kid brings to the problem argue that rhythm might give them some of the cues they need to discriminate language groups and so forth. Okay? But clearly that ability didn't evolve. For that reason, it rides on a much more general auditory mechanism. Okay. Many more experiments along those lines. Again, the conclusion seems to be at this point that every time people working with animals look for a either homologous or an analogous mechanism for perception, they find it. The null hypothesis is, in terms of both sensory production and perception, we share those with other animals. Okay, so what about computation? So here is an interesting phenomenon, which many of you probably know, which is at some point around the age of 1 year, children begin to acquire words, and then there's this exponential function where they are building on words at an extraordinary rate. And one of the ways in which that happens is because we are great vocal learners. We can imitate. And if we didn't have that capacity, we wouldn't be able to do this. I want to ask about a question which comes prior to this, which is how does a child figure out what a word is? Right? Who tells the kid, hey, this is a word. Pay attention. Here comes a word. Right? Nobody does that. But you might think they do is they go, look, kid, this is a video controller. Right, and they point it, video controller, video controller, video controller. And the kid goes, okay, video controller, right? But the kid never got, this is a. Nobody speaks that way, and nobody points to anything when they say that either. Right? So how did the kid get, this is a? Well, what you may be thinking is, well, the way the kid gets, this is a, is because there's a pause between this is a. But that's also not true. Sometimes there are pauses between words, but there are often pauses within words. So if a child's sitting there going, okay, every time I hear a pause, I'm going to draw a line and say that's a word, sometimes they'd be right, sometimes they'd be wrong. That can't work. Well, here's another possibility. This is one that was brought up by Zelig Harris and Noam Chomsky in the 50s. They suggest the possibility that if the child is equipped with statistical mechanisms that would allow the child to track transitional probabilities between phonemes in the language, they might pick up on the fact that certain phonemes follow each other and other ones don't. Some phonemes typically end a word, some phonemes typically begin a word, and other ones don't. In English, we don't ever begin a word with NG. We end words with NG, and in some languages, we begin words with NG. So if a child's sort of listening to those phonemes and picking up the statistics, they should be able to figure out what the word boundaries are. Well, in 1996, Jenny Safran, Alyssa Newport, and Dick Aslan tested the hypothesis with the following method. They familiarized babies to hearing a continuous stream of consonant vowels that sounded like this. Okay, now you only got that for about 30 seconds, but you probably have already picked out, it probably just jumped out at you, that things like ti-la-do appear very often, right? You heard that a lot. Well, the reason why you heard that a lot is because in this corpus, things like t always precede la, which always precedes do, with a probability of 1. Okay? So they created certain transitional probabilities that were very high and other ones that were very low. And we know from thousands and thousands of studies of babies that if you familiarize them to a corpus and if they've extracted out whatever the property is that's common, then when you present them with new things that are common in the same kind of way, they shouldn't respond to those, but things that are novel, unexpected, they should respond to. The kinds of methods that Liz and Susan, I'm sure, talked to you about when they were here. So what they did was they then, after familiarization, tested the babies with isolated segments of three consonants and vowels, T, La, Do, and Da, Pi, Ku, which were words that always appeared together, non-words where the three CVs never appeared together, so B was never next to Da and never next to Ku, and part words where the P always came before the Ku, but Pa was never the ending CV. The correction is, babies should look longer at non-words than part words than words, and that's precisely what they found. So at the age of 8 months, babies have a statistical mechanism that allows them to compute transitional probabilities. Well, the question becomes, is this mechanism one that evolved for language? Because other animals don't have vocalizations that are these long continuous strings where you have to segment. Segmenting is not a problem for other animals in the same way that it is for us. So maybe that's a mechanism that evolved uniquely for us because we had this problem. Now, of course, transitional probabilities are things that could be operating in other domains, like foraging. If I see a tree that has these properties, then I expect fruit of a certain kind. That might be true. Okay, but it's possible this is a mechanism evolved uniquely for humans. The question is true. Do you have a question?
Yes. My child is 3 years old, and she makes mistakes with the limits because in French you have the liaison.
That's right.
So the computational ability doesn't rule out some mistakes. It's not possible to have the. It doesn't violate the. It violates the rule, but not to the point where the rule doesn't exist.
Oh, absolutely, and more to the point. You're excellent point because. This can't account for all language access. This is simply one rule that might get them into the system, right? So you'll see what's coming next is other rules that may be necessary. This is the tip of the iceberg. This is nothing, right? And clearly, if your child grew up with French, they're going to be parsing in a very different way. So they've already had a brain which is fine-tuned to different kinds of rules, and that's what we get to next, okay? So the question now is simply, is this mechanism one that's unique to humans because of the segmentation problem, period? Yeah.
What happens when, what lessons, if it's not a probably reality, when the part words are actual words, like I was thinking about this last night since we read the study for class, just the word ideal lab outcome, could also be deal, well, if you look at it, lab outcome could also be, the way lab goes into outcome, it occurs just as frequently in the language stream as lab and then outcome, and con works. I'm saying when it breaks down in different ways and it would work just as well, how can they hear it as lab outcome, about outcome?
I'm not sure I completely understand your question. Well, in this case, the only information they could use to get the result, right? I mean, the only way you can get this result is they pulled out the transitional process because nothing else was in. There's no information. There's no stress patterns in this. I mean, you heard it. It's completely flat stressed. There's no core articulation, so there's no other information in the signal. Okay? So in this particular case, they controlled for all the rest and only gave. See, there is no segmentation in this thing, right? So there's no boundaries there at all. It's completely continuous. There are no stress patterns. There's no core articulation. The only thing in there are statistical relationships between consonant and vowels.
So in real speech, we would not, unless we stress differently.
Oh, yeah. In real speech, this is not the way the world works. Right? Much more complicated, which is what we're getting to next. Okay? This is, because both these questions are exactly the same. This is a simple cut. It's saying, do babies who are very, very little, 8 months, have any mechanism to compute transitional probabilities? Right? That's all. It's saying, at a first cut, can they do that? If they can't do that, then it possibly isn't even a mechanism, or it's not a mechanism until later in development. Right? Okay? But don't forget, 8 months is getting very close to the age when kids have words, right? Some kids at 10 months at least have comprehension of words, right? Pretty well, in fact, right? So they've already begun to segment. The question is, how are they doing it, right? So this is the first cut in the mechanism, right? But you see, there's many more. Okay. Yep.
So would you say that the babies at this age are sort of like breaking a code, like a secret code, and that sort of computation is going on with the probability?
They are using a mechanism that allows them to break into the system. Right. I mean, so the real question in language acquisition are what are the mechanisms that the child brings to the task, right? And except for, to me, the really, no, this is terrible to say, those are thinking naively about it, but I'll say it anyways. I think it's kind of a silver bullet mechanism. That's not true. There are lots of mechanisms that are brought into language acquisition. The rhythmic properties are mechanisms, right? And they're probably working together, right? So at this point, nobody's brought out kind of the silver bullet mechanism that can explain everything. Right. The kid's using lots of cues. They're using contextual information. I mean, look, this helps. This is video controller, right? I mean, that really helps the word segmentation, right? Right? Why ignore it, right? It's there, okay? So the simple question is here, do they have the computations here? Okay. Yep?
Do you think that infants have a lot of concepts before they have language?
That opens up a whole other can of worms, which I'd rather deflect to the end if we have time, just because it's a whole completely different issue in one sense, right? It's saying other conceptual issues that are going on here. The simple answer is yes. They have lots of conceptual resources before they have the words to express them. Right? All of, to me, Susan Carey and Liz Felke's work is exactly what that's after. So that's the simple answer. Okay, so just to move on so we can get through to some of the other pieces, I think just to fill in the story, is we ran exactly the same procedure with the monkeys. We familiarized them passively to hearing exactly the same corpus that Jenny Safran used with the babies, as you read about, and we test them with exactly the same method. Okay? and the results are here, and you saw them. So consistently, the monkeys respond more to the non-words and the part words, multiple replications of this, multiple different kinds of designs, same exact result. Okay? So here again, that mechanism clearly is not unique to humans. It's being used by the monkeys for potentially other reasons. We don't know why. But this is where the game becomes interesting. This is where these two last questions really become, I think, of most interest. So you're bored now, right? Okay. Good. Oh, what happened here? Oh, can you close your eyes a second? No. Let me just fix them. No, there's no mind. Never mind. Okay, so the question now becomes, what about other statistics? Right? That's not enough for language. And one of the things that's interesting about language, of course, is the fact that many of the relationships we see in languages are not local relationships. They're things that happen at a distance. Okay? And therefore, what you want to be able to ask with the same kind of methods is, well, what about statistical relationships that are not at, adjacencies? What about non-adjacent relationships? So unfortunately, this got out of order, so you're going to see the result before the question. But let me just put them up, both up here. So look up here on top now. We now want to ask the question of, what about non-adjacent syllables? So now the relationship is, given C1 and V1, CN, VN, and C3, V3, C1, V1 is always together with C3, V3, and the middle CV is always free to vary. Okay? And this shows parallels with Arabic. Arabic has relationships in its language where the correlations are with non-adjacent CVs. The question is, what will happen comparing humans and non-humans? And this is now a comparison between human adults and tamarins. Adults fail, and tamarins succeed. Now that, at first, Lisa Newport and Dick Aslan, who were the collaborators in this, said, no way. You have to run the monkeys again. Right? Like, okay, we'll run them again. So we ran them again, we got exactly the same result. Okay. So, well, you have to run the human adults again. Said, we've run them 20 times. They still can't get it. Right? Well, listen. Just listen to this. Here's what it sounds like. And see if you can now pull out the words. Now, hopefully for most of you, it was kind of harder than that original, where it seemed just to jump out at you instantaneously, right? Well, that's what seems to be happening for human adults. They don't hear what are the words. Tamarins find this trivial.
What about Arab speakers?
Yeah. Well, okay, so these are tested with human adults, English speakers, right? Open question about what Arabic speakers would do, right? Very good question, important, right? But don't forget, tamarins are not Arabic speakers. Okay, so... So for both, it's funny, but it's also important because for both subjects, they're English speech syllables, right? So don't forget, we're still playing English speech syllables. It's the correlations that are important, and the correlations are novel for both species, right? But it's a good question about whether the tuning of an Arabic speaker would give them this, right? Yeah. No? Yeah.
There's a possibility that because we do use language, we've come fine to change the rules of our own language. That's harder for us. Like with learning a second language at a certain age, we can't reproduce the same thing.
Okay, great. So now comes the question of why this result. Okay. Well, one thing is the tuning of our own language, which gives us different correlations. Another possibility, which is the one that we went after, is the following. We know from studies of speech production errors, from studies of brain damage patients, in particular Alfonso Caramazza's work, showing that you can find patients who have damage for consonants, but not vowels. Other ones have damage for vowels, not consonants. And what that tells us is that when we process speech, we can process at different levels. It's a hierarchy, right? And one of the levels of the hierarchy is the phonemic tier. Consonants. Oh, you lost me. Oh, I think you lost me again. Can I just yell? Can you hear me back?
You need it.
What do you think? That's gone. Okay?
Yep.
Okay, so we know from studies of normal speech production errors and also brain damage patients that, particularly the patient cases of Alfonso Caramazza, that you can find patients who have a deficit for consonants but not vowels and the reverse. So we know there's an organization that's hierarchical in terms of speech that involves a phonemic tier, right? The phonemes, you know, consonants and vowels. So one possibility here is that when humans, in general, hear speech, they're not pulling out at the level of the CV. They're pulling out the level of a consonant and a vowel. Right. So now the question becomes, what about the same test where the non-adjacent relationships are between consonants or between vowels? What happens? Right. Well, here's what happens. For consonants, which now is very much like Hebrew, human adults have no problems, but the tamarins are a chance. Okay? So now that I'm looking at it, now again, this is just one away. But now what's one away is the consonants, where the vowels are free to vary. And here's what this kind of sounds like, just quickly. So, potentially for some of you at least, that was more salient. The words were kind of popping out. At least for most people it is. I gave you like 10 seconds. Human adults are given 2 minutes, so it becomes salient. No problem. Okay, now, another hypothesis. For tamarins, the salient unit is a CV, but for humans, the salient perceptual unit is the phoneme. And that predicts is that humans have no problem with phonemes, and therefore they should be able to do consonants and vowels. Tamarins should fail on consonants and vowels. So we go to vowels. But here, both species do fine.
Yeah.
Okay, well, it's more complicated. Let me just finish the explanation, then you can ask questions. So here, both of them do fine. Okay, they get the difference. Now, another hypothesis comes forward. Well, this certainly rules out tamarins can't do phonemic tier, because they can. They can do vowels, but they can't do consonants, maybe. Well, one way that might be right is because if you look at the sounds that tamarins and other non-human primates produce, they do not produce consonants in their repertoires. They produce lots of vowel-like sounds. Woo, ee, right? That's the kind of sound that a monkey makes. Okay? So, it may be that through evolution, how their perceptual system got tuned up was for vowel-like sounds, and consonants are simply not salient to them. That's important in terms of the interaction between perception and computation. So let me take your question.
I just had a minor question about why you switched to adults and not
to didn't switch to adults, just haven't run babies yet. So that's an open question too, right? And that's a beautiful question, right? Are babies more like tamarins or are they more like human adults, right? That's a great question. We're waiting to get the answer to that because that's critical. It may be that babies are born into the world where CVs are salient, and then only later do phonemes become salient. That would be a wonderful story of development, right? Who knows? So here's what we can say then about this body of work. Tamarins can compute non-adjacent conditional probabilities, but only when they can extract the appropriate unit of analysis, CV syllables or vowels, at least so far as we can tell. In the absence of training, because again, remember these non-training studies, tamarins perceive CVs and vowels as salient acoustic units, but unlike human adults, do not perceive consonants as such. This is critical because it really highlights the interface between computation and perception.
Mark?
Yep.
Back in the Paleolithic era, by which I mean 30 years ago, there was a well-known theory of, I think it was called analysis by synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw everything you were saying until the last few minutes as sort of demolishing that.
Mm-hmm.
But this suggests that there may be an aspect of analysis by synthesis in the tamarins because the vowels are the kinds of sounds that they have an easier time making, and maybe that's what's carrying the CV to some extent.
That's right. So that hypothesis would reopen that question, right? Up until that last comment, the idea was that the motor theory of speech is dead because they can't produce these sounds, and therefore how could they be perceiving them the way that we do? But if it turns out there's a tuning based on what they can produce, then that reopens that question. Now, what we are in the process of doing is we only test a small range of consonants, so we can't yet rule out consonants as unperceivable by them. The other question, of course, is that in order for them to do CVs, at some level they're perceiving consonants, but it may be just via co-articulation, right? So it's the consonant's effect on the vowel that is creating the CV structure. It's not the consonant per se that they're hearing. Those are wide open questions, wide open, right, at this point in time. But the nice thing is that now we've got a method we can ask, right? So wide open. Okay, I'm going to skip Gary Marcus, except to tell you that for those of you who know the paper, that also works with monkeys. Because I want to get to the much more interesting last experiment that you've not heard about because it's not published. this is one of my favorite cartoons. I sent it to Noam because I said, this encapsulates your life, politics and linguistics. So the enemy of my enemy is my friend, my enemy is his best friend, my enemy's friend, da-da-da. It kind of gets complicated because it shows the problem of embedding, but it also shows the power of recursion, right? Because you can just keep going. So I use that as an introduction to this idea. So in the 50s, Syntactic Structures, one of Noam's books, he proposed the idea that you can think about language as a hierarchy of increasing complexity in terms of computational rules. And at the lowest level of that hierarchy was what he referred to as a finite state grammar. And basically, everything I've told you about so far is such a grammar. It is characterized by local relationships between symbols or variables. Okay. Now, that's not enough to get language. Absolutely not. Right. But the next step up is what he referred to as a phrase structure. And this is now where you begin to get recursive elements that give you some of the open-ended power of language. Phrase structures are also not enough for language for lots of reasons which don't need to concern us here, but simply a move up in the hierarchy. So together with the information I just skipped by Gary Marcus, which is also a finite Siskel rule, we had already had quite a bit of evidence that monkeys can do finite state grammars. What we didn't yet have was any evidence they could do a phrase structure. The reason why that's important is because it introduces recursion. And if they can do it, now we've got a real test of the question about uniqueness for recursion. So here is what Tecumseh, Fitch, and I have done. And just to let you know, this hasn't been done on babies. It's been done on human adults, and it's been done on tamarins. And we have no answers yet for human infants of any age. We created two grammars, one a finite state that we defined as A, B to the N. Let me just walk you through what the rule is. The rule states that all A elements or tokens will appear before all B tokens. There will be an equal number of A, B clusters. In our corpus, we had four different A's and four different examples of B's, and what those examples were consonants and vowels. Okay? So there were four different CBs for the A's, and again, four different ones for the B's. So we habituated them to exemplars that fit the rule. So A1, B1, A2, B2, A1, B1, A1, B1, A1, B1. Alternations of A's and B's, given exemplars of A's and B's. Okay? If they pull out the rule, then the test, we give them new exemplars that fit the rule, like A3, B4, and we give them violations. And there can be a bunch of different kinds of violations, like A1, B4, A3 fits the order in that A's come before B's, but it's an asymmetry, because there should be another B followed by A3 because it should be an equal number of them, right? B2, A1 is a violation because B's come before A's, and that's a violation, even though it's symmetrical. Okay? So if they picked up the rule, they should respond to the bad ones and not to the good ones, or respond to the violations and not respond to the consistent ones. You can take that finite state rule and change it into a phrase structure by a simple move, which is A to the N, B to the N, because now you get embedding, okay, where you can branch out and go forward this way, and now it becomes very open-ended. The rule is simply A before B, equal numbers of A's and B's, 4A tokens, 4B tokens, like the above, and unique CB syllables. Okay, so in a sense, they're very parallel. You habituate them to exemplars that fit A1, A2, B1, B2, and so forth, and then you give them violations. But now note, the violations, there are three. I've only listed two here. This violation is a violation of symmetry, so there are three A's and two B's. This is a violation of order, but another violation is this. A, B, A, B, A, B. A's before B's, symmetrical number, but no. In this rule, all A's have to come before all B's. So the prediction is if they pick up this phrase structure, they should respond to the violations and not to the consistent ones. So we test the tamarins. Here's what they do in the finite state. They have absolutely no problem with this. They respond much more to the violations than to the consistent ones. You test them on the phrase structure, and they completely fail. Test human adults, and they get both. You ask them what the rule is for the phrase structure, they haven't a clue. Nobody gave us the rule, even though, on average, people were, you can see, almost at ceiling. Right? Nobody told us what the rule was. It's completely implicit. Okay, conclusions. Well, you and all seem to implicitly learn A to the N, B to the N. That's beautiful, because you have no clue why you're speaking the way you're speaking. Right? You don't know what the rules are. You're just talking. Right? That seems to be what's going on here. This is a recursive rule, but we can't pick it out. That's nice. But Terrence can't even do that. They can't even learn the rule. But why might they fail? This is where this area of research gets to be extremely difficult and problematic. and it's problematic in both directions. If we fail, at some level we have a null result. Those are always hard to explain. I'm going to tell you why I think we can rule out some things. If we got a positive result, that's problematic. I gave a talk at MIT. Morris Halley said, look, Mark, even if they had succeeded, you wouldn't have a real result. And that's because how do you test for infinity? Right? If it's recursive, it's completely open-ended. Now, of course, we can do that with humans, which is why it's called discrete infinity, because I can keep inventing new sentences. But how do you test for that empirically with an animal? Right? It's a tough one. Okay? So this is hard both directions. But here's at least what we can rule out some of the failures. Well, one reason why they may fail is because they don't have a phrase structure system. They don't have recursion. Secondly, maybe they fail to pull out what counts as A and B. That seems unlikely on a number of levels. We already showed in all the experiments I've shown you, they can pull out what a CV is, right? They have no problem with CVs. And they get the finite state grammar, which is also CVs. In fact, it's the same set. So that seems highly unlikely, right? Third, to get the phrase structure, you have to be able to count. 1, 2, 3 A's, 1, 2, 3 B's, same, right? Maybe the deficiency is in the number area. Okay, tied to that, going back to an earlier question, maybe it's a constraint of working memory. You've got to count up, store, and compare. Maybe they're just deficient in terms of working memory. Okay, so those are all possibilities, and there are others. Okay, the question is, can we rule some out? What I want to do is tell you how I can quickly rule out these last two. We have a huge amount of information on the number capacities of animals, and I think maybe Susan, Liz spoke about some of this. So I don't have to bore you with that. There's just an overwhelming amount of information on number capacities. Let me just rule out in a very precise way by showing you the result of a paper that I just published with Stanislaw Dehaene, which asked the question about auditory number discrimination. So we used our playback technique. We habituated the animals to hearing speech syllables, either two or three, like ba, ba, sa, sa, sa. Okay, one group got habituated to two, another group got habituated to three. And then we tested them on tones. I have two or three tones. So we're changing formats. But number is either the same or number is different. Terrans have no problem with that. They rarely discriminate the different number. They respond much more to a different number than the same number. This is in the range of the numbers that we were using for the phrase structure grammar. It also involves working memory, because if they store up the numbers they're being habituated to, remember that, and now compare it with the test items. So working memory and number capacity can't be what's causing the failure. Okay, so quickly, phrase structure failure is not due to a number limit or an impoverished working memory system. And this is the conclusion, which is that it looks like, maybe, the capacity of recursion may be absent in non-human primates and other animals. But this is the beginning of comparative work. How have you really begun? Right? And we haven't begun in two ways. Nobody's run any of these experiments on other animals. Maybe rhesus monkeys are much smarter than tamarins. Maybe chimpanzees are much smarter than rhesus monkeys. Who knows? Maybe birds are smarter than any of them because of their song structure, they've got a system which can do this stuff. Who knows? Maybe insects. I mean, it's unclear, right, where it's going to lie, if at all. Maybe the recursive system is not even in the area of communication or computation. So maybe it's in some completely different domain altogether. Remember, for Chomsky at least, recursion could evolve for reasons that have nothing to do with language. Maybe it's there in other species in things like social relationships, spatial navigation, number. Who knows? Okay? The domain is simply wide open to be looked at. Okay, so coming back to these issues now, coming back to that original figure, what seems to be going on is that we've now got, I think, a way of thinking about the problem in a way which is empirical, right? Which has not been the case, I think, before because of confusion about what the questions were, A, and B, methods that allow you to test what's going on. So let me just end with sort of telling you what I think I am and I'm not saying. So far, the evidence for homology is at the behavioral and computation level. We yet do not know anything about what's going on at the neural basis. We just started, and we're going to begin doing the first sets of scans in January. We now have the capacity to do fMRI with our monkeys, which we'll be doing up in Worcester beginning in January, looking at not only do they show behavioral homology, but do they show neurobiological homology, right? Is it happening in the same parts of the brain that's happening in humans? Have no idea, right? Secondly, the faculty of language has both shared and unique components. At present, what appears to be unique is the recursive system. And most likely, the interfaces that go between that recursive system and the phonological and semantic systems. Oops, sorry. But lastly, we have absolutely no idea about what the evolutionarily selective pressures were on creating those specializations. Right? Nobody has any idea yet. But that's where the comparative database will be so informative. Right? If we find these capacities distributed in weird sorts of ways in the animal kingdom, we can now begin to look at what the ecological pressures were in terms of those capacities. So that's where the comparative program really begins to open the door in terms of selective pressures. So I hope you will be convinced that the comparative approach is relevant, and I'll leave you with this movie clip. Thanks. I think we have a few minutes, 5 minutes? I have faculty council in 5 minutes, so.
Why can't you pronounce nuclear? Or where was the clock? Nuclear.
Why can't George Bush?
Why can't he produce nuclear? Oh. Because he still has the old mammalian vocal tract.
I was going to ask him somewhere how much evolution actually took place in that one.
Very little.
Mark, I'd like to maybe return to the modularity test. You know Masataka, of course. He started a lot of work related to yours. He has a new book coming out, and he says, you know, linguists have argued that language requires specialized mental mechanisms that are encapsulated or dissociated from other more generalized processing systems. However, they have not yet presented actual evidence for this. This goes back to that modularity.
Mm-hmm.
Is this evidence for it?
Well, I mean, so there's a couple of things. One is that, which is the part which I didn't speak about, is there does look like there's a lot of shared stuff in the conceptual intentional domain, but which I didn't talk about, but there are pieces which may be, in fact, be very, very different. So referentiality, which I haven't spoken about at all, there are things that are out there which I've spoken about before, which I was much more enthusiastic about in my earlier days than I am now, which I was much more pessimistic about in this paper with Noam. So the very, very fast version of the story is that there are examples of animal vocalizations which look like they're word-like. That's been the claim. So vervet monkeys giving alarm calls that are different for different kinds of predators, and animals responding as if the predator was there, right, just by the sound alone. It turns out they're very different in very many number of ways, which I think are critical to thinking about the mechanism. Okay, so there's a case where referentiality could be something that's very, very distinctive. Now, the capacity to refer, of course, depends clearly on the conceptual abilities. I think one of the puzzles there, which is kind of how I ended, you know, my book Wild Minds, is that to me the puzzle is that I think animals have incredibly rich conceptual abilities but don't have the vehicle to express it. Right? And that's a statement, almost a fact in the following sense. And people always say, you know, this is the comment I always get back. Well, look, Mark, you know, you don't really understand what they're talking about. I say, you're right, I don't. But here's what's going on. When a chimpanzee vocalizes, they go, how many bits of information can you code in that? Right? Now, either they're like Martians who have become incredibly efficient, and then we're really stupid because we evolved this really arcane system. We have to talk a lot, say something, which seems really unlikely. But just the pure bits of information can't be in there, right? They don't string them together. If you watch chimpanzees, they're not doing what you and I are doing. They don't have these kind of conversations like this, right? It's a grunt here, look around, Yeah, that's about it, right? Okay, so there's just not enough bits, okay? So to me, the puzzle is, but they have incredibly rich conceptual lives. I mean, all the work on concepts is just very rich, but they can't talk about it. So that's a key thing. The second thing, which is a puzzle too, is vocal learning. There is no evidence that non-human primates show vocal imitation. That's a puzzle. Birds do. So the uniqueness claim is not at stake here because the birds can do it fine. Monkeys and apes cannot. Critically, to acquire a lexicon, you have to be able to do vocal learning. Right? Okay. So there are those pieces, and I think, again, but, you know, imitation certainly is not domain-specific, right? The capacity to refer is something we do in language, right? But, of course, we can do it, we can kind of weakly do it in gesture, we can kind of weakly do it in music, but people have often made parallels between, say, the music system and the language system. And there are clear cases of dissociation where you lose music but not language, and the reverse, right, suggesting dissociations. But music doesn't have the referential capacities that language does. No way. People say, well, you can have music to refer to move. But they're using refer in a very loose and, to me, unquantitative way. So with reference, right? I think it's something that's particular to language. And those seem to show cases of, again, brain damage and modularity. All the service properties of linguistics are things you don't see in any other domain, right? All, I mean, I mentioned briefly in the paper, you know, WH movement, kind of garden path variety sentences, all these things are quirks of language. There's no evidence of any of that in any other domain. So, but see, I think, you know, it's still the case. I mean, I think Noam still holds on to the modularity thesis. But what is the modular piece, I think, is up for grabs. And I think, you know, this is where Steve Pinker's comment to me. I think I'm looking forward to seeing how he changes his views after this paper. But you know, if he's willing to say that recursion is a simple system that had dramatic consequences, well, then, clearly, he doesn't say at all that it's modular. Recursion is used in mathematics all the time. Right? So, I mean, that's where the game is going to have to be is in terms of modularity. What is?
But when he talked about recursion 30 or 40 years ago, he piggybacked things like mathematics on recursion.
Yeah, he wants to have it that mathematics just was a later development that piggybacked on the recursion for language. But he always is very clear that recursion didn't evolve for the expressive part of language. That was always very clear. He still, I think, wants to think that the number system piggybacked on it. That's why I think developmental studies are going to be very, very interesting. Because the question is, the capacities for mathematics in kids, which of the capacities that involve recursion come in first, the linguistic parts or the mathematical parts? Wide open, don't know. I mean, now that we have ways of asking questions about simple kinds of additions and subtractions, right, we can begin to get at operations of number. We can do those experiments with animals, too. Will we ever get to the point where we can ask for recursive capacities? I don't know. You know, it's very, very hard. Yeah?
Can any non-human primates who have been raised by humans ever been capable of vocalizing sounds that are atypical, you know, do the ee-oo-oo sounds, but have any been able to be trained to make those humans vocalizations?
No. The Hayeses in the 50s really, really tried, and people have tried. You know, Sue Savage Rumbaugh would love to have Kanzi speaking, and she claims that he does. But I went to a conference where she made this claim, and I said, you know, Sue, you know, I really want to see this. Can you show us a videotape? We'll turn our back and we'll interpret what he's saying. She goes, that wouldn't be fair. I said, well, why wouldn't it be fair? You know, if you do that with a human, no problem, right? So, you know, yeah, there are claims out there, but they're nothing to cry home. I mean, you know, Alex the parrot can talk fine, right? But, you know, that's a very different system, and Alex is an imitator because parrots imitate beautifully, right? And they're doing something that which is basically simulating speech. But no non-human primate.
Thanks.
You're welcome.